I'm Emily Alphen Johnson, VPR Digital Producer. I just wanted to let you know that this episode of Vermont Edition has been edited for clarity and brevity.
This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. Roughly 1 in 10 employed Vermonters belong to a union, and nearly half of those jobs are in public sectors like government or teaching. The role of organized labor has changed dramatically in recent decades, with union jobs declining in Vermont and nationwide. But organized labor and how employers have responded to it has profoundly shaped Vermont's history and culture. We're going to talk about that today, and we're joined first by Paul Searles, who's a social sciences associate professor at Linden State College. He's the author of the book To Vermont's Geography and Identity. Professor Searles, nice to have you back on the program.
Thank you for having me.
So we're actually at about, I think, 11.5% of employed Vermonters work in union shops. Do you have a sense of where they typically work?
My understanding is they largely work in the public sector. They work at places like the State College System, the University of Vermont, and in other avenues of education, high schools and elementary schools, and then also in other public service jobs associated with the state government.
And does that track with what we see nationwide in terms of people who work in unions these days?
Yes.
How does our average compare to the national average?
Our average is about the same. We have a smaller number on average of workers outside the public sector who are members of unions, but that has more to do with the nature of Vermont's economy than any sort of a matter of public policy.
You mean because we have different people work in different sectors here than they might in other parts of the country?
Yeah, you know, Vermont had one economy at one time that has almost ceased to exist. Dairy farming, of course, is much smaller than it used to be, which was not a unionized sector of the economy. And then you also had light industry, things like textile manufacturing, and extractive industries like quarrying, where you saw the most union activity, and lumbering. And those sectors of the economy mostly, you know, sort of collapsed in the 20th century, and now we have much more a focus on medicine and high tech.
All right, so Paul, you're starting to get us into the history here and how things have changed here, and that's affected the way our unions operate and how many of them and where people are in unions. But take us back. How important have unions been to Vermont's history?
It's a long and fascinating and complex history, actually. I mean, it exists in a very interesting and almost, you know, sort of unique context. And Vermont has a very interesting industrial past, but it is not by any means has had a overwhelmingly industrial history. It is more rural, has traditionally been more rural than other states, and that's been affected, has been reflected by its union history.
So when we talk about this long history and how it's shaped the state, you know, when was the peak? When would you say the peak of union membership was?
The peak of union membership was during World War II and after it. Traditionally, Vermonters were very, at best, skeptical of organized labor. It really reflects the rural aspect nature of the state. And whereas there were some real sort of strength hotbeds of union activity, particularly in Barrie in the granite industry, a lot of other parts of the economy, textiles and the machine tool industry, to name two, were really resistant to union activity until we got to World War II. And the War Labor Board intervened in the state, as it did around the country, and facilitated the ability of workers to organize. And so when you come out of World War II, there's a lot of union activity. There's a really high rate of union membership. But what happened was, I mean, demographic and economic reasons, not necessarily associated with union membership, a lot of those industries began to go into decline by the 1950s and 60s.
So was it just the fact that those industries went into decline that led to a lessening of power of unions, or is there some other cultural force at work here as well?
Well, I wouldn't say that it's a lessening of power necessarily. It's just sort of a transition from one kind to another. Unions have never had an enormous influence in Vermont, in politics certainly. The way that the state legislature was apportioned until 1965 was that it was one town got one vote, which meant that the smallest towns had as much representation as Burlington. So something along the lines of 12 or 13% of the state's population could muster, you know, 125 of the state's towns in the legislature. And so the legislature traditionally was pretty hostile to organized labor's interests.
So in that way, it feels like perhaps there was has never been much of a power, at least in terms of how the legislature could shape it. Do you see power in other ways, though?
Height of power for organized labor, again, was not only just after World War II, but before it. During the early 1930s, the granite workers in Barrie were very successful in organizing in that industry. And they were led by a really dynamic man named John C. Lawson. And Lawson was on the fringes of politics until George Aiken took over in 1937. And Aiken formed a real partnership with Lawson. And not only did he form a partnership with him, but he facilitated a cooperative relationship between Lawson and the Vermont Farm Bureau under Arthur Packard. Aiken used to always say that, tell farmers that a union is like a cooperative, a milk cooperative. It's people combining together in order to look out for their interests. And so Lawson was really the pathway for organized labor to form a really important part of influence in the state politics. And also, St. Michael's College took a real interest in union activities and had a union school at night. And also Goddard College as well was really sort of a center for unions to organize and to hold conferences.
So what do you see the picture looking like today when you look at where we've come from in Vermont and the decline in certain industries, particularly in manufacturing, and with them often a decline in unions and yet a rise in public sector jobs? And that may account for a slight rise we've seen in the last couple years, specifically in Vermont in terms of union sector jobs. How do you, you know, where what's the sort of context that you would put us in for what the shape of union membership and unions are like today?
Well, I am a historian and not an expert on unions in the present. I would say I am also admittedly a member of a collective bargaining unit in the Vermont State College system. But where they are right now is sort of, I guess, in a really sort of a holding pattern. And if I had to do any sort of comparison, I guess it would sort of have to be the 1950s, I guess, you know, where the union membership had a good grip on the jobs that it held, but it wasn't necessarily expanding. And there was, of course, a lot of hostility still towards unions, not only in the legislature, but in the population in general. It is less true, certainly, though, that some of the reasons for that antipathy towards organized labor exist now. They're for different reasons. One of the really big motivating factors for opposition to unions back before World War II had to do with ethnicity. Unions nationwide, but especially in Vermont, were associated with Catholics, with Italians and the Irish and things like this. And it wasn't considered really sort of respectable for Yankees to join unions. And big sectors of the state, the Northeast Kingdom in particular, and down around Brattleboro were places that were very hostile to unions on the part of the population. So, you know, I mean, if there is opposition to unions in the state now, they often stem from different causes.
I'm Jane Lindholm, and this is Vermont Edition. Today we're talking about unions, both their strength in Vermont, but also the culture of unions, how they're perceived, and what value they hold for employees, and how employers work with unions these days. Robert says, I'm a proud member of Office and Professional Employees International Union, Local 6, at Rutland Regional Medical Center. Being a member of my collective bargaining unit gives me a contract with my employer. It stipulates that for a designated period of time, usually 3 years, the conditions and wages that will prevail while I work there. There is no union protection for not doing my job, nor should there be. Management and the union here have developed a very collegial relationship. Though there are differences, both sides are able to call upon the other and have a conversation about issues before they get out of control. I am proud of both my union membership and that I'm employed at Rutland Regional Medical Center. Thanks for that note, Robert. We've been talking with Paul Searles, a professor at Lyndon State College, who's written a book called Two Vermonts, Geography and Identity. He's with us, and also with us now is Elaine McCrate, a UVM professor of economics and women's studies. And as a labor economist, she specializes in the political economy of low-wage labor markets. Professor McCrate, nice to have you with us.
Thank you. It's nice to be here.
So how would you contextualize Vermont's union landscape and where things are today in terms of the power of unions and the perceived power of unions?
Unions in Vermont have not been strong because we don't have a lot of the large industries, the automobile industry, the steel industry, which in the heyday of unions were really important and set the pattern for so many other workers. We've never had that. We have smaller unions, smaller employers. We do have a lot of public sector workers. About half of our public sector workers are covered by collective bargaining agreements.
Let's go to our calls. Dan is on the line with us from Brattleboro. Hi, Dan. Go right ahead.
Hi, Jane.
Hi.
I've been a registered nurse for 22 years, and I've worked at unionized and non-unionized facilities, and I've just found, by and large, pay and benefits and ability to negotiate with management are greatly enhanced by belonging to a union. A time ago, Vermont Edition did a segment on the income disparity between men and women in the workforce, and unions completely eliminate that problem in my perception, being that depending on what level of degree you have and what level of education degrees you have, you make the exact same amount no matter what your gender is. And I think it just makes sense to kind of follow the money. If unions aren't good for employees, why does management spend millions of dollars on really seedy, shady, union-busting law firms, largely that come from the South? The author, his name is escaping me, but I'd encourage people to read a book called Confessions of a Union Buster, which details at length the seedy lengths that management will go to, fear, intimidation, outright lies, to try and take away people's ability to belong to a collective bargaining union.
Dan, I appreciate your call and appreciate your perspective, and I'm intrigued by your assertion or your idea that this can help eliminate wage gaps between men and women. Professor McCrae, is that something that you see, that unions have an ability to sort of decrease gender disparities?
Yeah, gender disparities and race disparities is a longstanding pattern.
Professor Searles, what do you see in the history of this? I mean, we think about, as you and I have talked about and as Professor McCrae has brought in, these ideas about which sectors have typically had unions, and many of them, manufacturing, were historically very male-dominated. But, you know, you think back to last week's program on Vermont Edition about millwork and millwork being done by women. Where do you see gender and race coming into this conversation?
Yeah, well, yes. The jobs that women typically did in Vermont were the kinds that were particularly resistant to unionization. Textile jobs, for example, are jobs in which the workers are relatively easily replaceable. I mean, if you compare that to, say, the granite industry in Barry, not only did the Barry granite workers coming from northern Italy have a long history in their home country of unionization, but they were very highly skilled workers, and they weren't easily replaceable. And the types of jobs that women did historically in manufacturing in Vermont tended to be low-skilled, and so therefore they were very bad candidates for unionization.
Is that still true today, Elaine McCrae, that low-skilled workers have a harder time unionizing?
Yes, that tends to be true because the jobs pay less, and then there's a lot of turnover. There's a lot of instability, and the jobs just really tend to be very, very marginal. It's not just the low pay. It's the kinds of commitments that your employer makes to you in terms of providing hours, benefits, lots of things.
Let's go to Andrew in South Burlington. Hi, Andrew. What are you thinking as we talk about unions?
Hello. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
I have a friend of mine who works for UPS, and they're a very strong union. And basically, he had an accident at an airport where the machine he was driving uncoupled the train behind him, and the train hit the engine. So he had to ground the plane and find another plane to take over. So anybody else probably would have got canned. But the union stepped in and saved his job. So, you know, darn lucky he had a union representative, because it was an accident. Anyplace else, it would have gone. And on the other hand, you know, teachers in Northwest Vermont or anywhere else that's unionized, they have a lot of power. I think it's too much power, because they can paralyze a whole part of the state if they're going to go on strike, because parents are, you know, scared. They got no place to bring their kids. And, you know, teachers do what they have to do. And some teachers I know, they don't want to go on strike. They just, because the union makes them, they have to go.
Well, so, Andrew, how do you think about that? When you try to think in your head then, you know, you've got these sort of competing ideas about how unions work, depending on your experience with them, your friend, and then, you know, thinking about teachers' unions having too much power, as you put it. How do you bring those two ideas together in your view of, you know, what the value of unions is?
Well, it depends on, you know, if you're the employee, being belonging to the union would be a coveted job because, you know, you're pretty much going to have it made for a while. And if you have seniority, you can, you know, I don't know if people do that or not, but, you know, they can basically coast a bit, if you want to use the word, because, you know, they got protected by a union. And if they don't perform, they have a union that's going to stand up for them. So that's too much power again. So I don't know what the answer is. It's, you're collective bargaining, so you have somebody at the table negotiating for you, and you have somebody representing the school board, and I don't know who has the more power, but it seems like it's just too much power. And it's, the college kids are coming out of college and they can't find a job teaching, so they have to take something else, because the teachers, never let go of their job until they retire, obviously, or pass away, or whatever comes first.
Andrew,
the jobs are so well sought after.
Yeah, thanks. I appreciate your perspective and grappling with those ideas. And listeners, I want to say that we're not doing a show just about the teachers' union, so this isn't going to be the whole topic of the show. But I'm interested, if that's a perspective that you're mulling over now, hearing Andrew talk about it, how do you hold ideas about unions that might seem to be in conflict with one another in your head when you're thinking about your own view about workers' rights and labor negotiations? And, if that's part of what's coming into play for you, if you have a moment to interrogate your own beliefs and want to give us a call and talk about, where you see those splits and how you kind of figure it all out for yourself, I'd love to hear your thoughts. 800-639-2211. Professor McCrade, is that Andrew saying, look, my friend was able to have protection when he was injured because he belonged to a union? That's a really great thing. And yet, I also see this idea of unions having too much power. They can go on strike. Can you have it both ways? Can you be sort of a union supporter and a union denouncer at the same time?
People can do that. Yeah, the circumstances change. What I would say with regard to the UPS worker, one of the most important things unions do is that they have your back. They have a grievance procedure. Most people think of unions in terms of the dollars and cents, but I think one of the most important things, and really the belly of the beast, is the grievance procedure, which means that if there's a contractual violation, then you go through a whole process and the worker is defended. And that doesn't happen anywhere else except in a union shop. There are some in-house other kinds of arbitration arrangements, but the employer controls those. So I think that's really important. As far as the teachers go, they had to worry more about, and I don't think they worried enough about, the consequences of a potential strike on the children and the families who are involved. And I think when that's relevant, that you need to go out to the community and tell them about what you're doing and why you're doing it, and need to find some way that maybe they can benefit from it. What in your contract is going to help the children? And I don't think unions can just go it alone.
Yeah, and I think there are probably many members of the teachers union who would say they have been doing that and that they do feel community support in that. I'm curious, mm-hmm. from you, Paul Searles, mm-hmm. when you look at this idea of union busting, and that's been brought up too, this idea of, I think Dan mentioned seedy lawyers, as he put it, coming in to try to bust up the union. How effective has that been through history in terms of decreasing union membership and union power?
Very effective, very effective. I was just talking about Barry right after World War I, which was very typical nationwide. The owners of the sheds announced that the unions were going to be operated on an open shop basis, and that the unions had no place in the industry anymore. Something they didn't regain for another decade. If you take the marble industry, which has a fascinating labor history, down around the Rutland area, you have to differentiate between organized labor and labor actions. There was a strike in the late 1860s, and the company brought in strikebreakers from Quebec. And then in the 1880s, a national organization called the Knights of Labor organized marble workers. The marble workers really organized themselves under the umbrella of the Knights of Labor. And they were able to elect on the United Labor ticket one of their own, a worker in the marble quarries, as the representative for Rutland to the state legislature. And the owner of the Vermont Marble Company, Redfield Proctor, was so dismayed by that that he went to the legislature and demanded that the town of Rutland be divided into three parts, that the workers who mostly lived in what became West Rutland would be isolated in their own little small part of town, and that the city of Rutland was spun off into another town, and then that he got to live in a new town, which he humbly named after himself, in the northern part of what had been the town of Rutland. And anyone who can go and divide a town into three parts and then name one of them after himself gives you an idea about the kind of power that Redfield Proctor had.
Yeah, I have tried to get my town to you know, make a little space for Lindholmville, and it has not been working. So maybe.
Yeah, well, that would be a village. I mean, this was a town.
Yeah,
this
it's pretty amazing.
Gilded Age power at its finest.
You know, you've talked a little bit about the power of stone workers in Vermont history and certainly in Union history. And let's bring another voice into this conversation here as well. Matt Peake is a business agent with the Granite Cutters Association in Barre. It's a union that represents more than 300 workers in central Vermont's granite industry. And it's an industry that Matt has worked in some capacity for the last 25 years. Matt, it's nice to have you on the program.
Thank you.
So when you look at what your union does, what do you see as the value of being in a union?
You guys have touched on some of the items. One of them is job protection if you're injured on the job or even off the job. We offer protection on both of those, layoffs, seniority, all those kind of things. So a lot of those things you've already discussed, we offer all that protection for our people.
So you support the union? You feel like it's been a valuable part of your work experience?
Most definitely. I'm a third-generation granite worker. My grandfather worked in the industry all of his life. My dad worked in it for 40 years, and now I've been in it for approaching 35 years.
What do you think the perception of unions is in Vermont? I mean, if you're, I don't know how much you're able to sort of look outside it since you're on the inside as well, but what do you see as how people view unions?
I think that, you know, especially in the granite industry, I don't know a lot of outside, but I know that within the granite industry, my people, you know, love the fact that they're part of a union, part of a decision-making process, able to go and vote on contracts and be part of their own livelihood, if you will.
What do you think are the biggest challenges in terms of what your union's facing moving forward?
One of the number one challenges we have is healthcare. It's the number one item that we face at the bargaining table when we negotiate is that we really can't. It's difficult to negotiate anything other than that. Once you get health care out of the way, then we can start negotiating wages and other benefits and life insurance and such. But health care is obviously the number one item for all of us.
Yeah, I mean, that's clearly a problem for employers, for employees, and for unions, right? I mean, everybody's not necessarily in the same boat, but everybody's trying to figure out how to pay for increasing costs of healthcare. But that's something that, for your union, often winds up being a sticking point with the negotiators on the other side?
Most definitely. It's just not the level of benefits. It's also the percentage that we pay. My membership, even though they work for different employers throughout the industry, the average that my people pay is 20% of the premium per month is what they pay to have their health care.
What about the other things that your union provides? You know, so we're talking about negotiating benefits, but there's more to a union than just that. What are the other things that are crucial to how the union functions and what it sees as its role?
So what happens is you talked about some of the, you know, you've highlighted a little bit on the benefits, but we have a pension plan that is 100% sponsored, paid for by the employers. It's been in existence since 1957. It provides many people with stability and retirement so that they can retire and have a good life. We also have a 401k. Which is primarily the employee's money, but also there is a match on that. Then we have vacation time for my people. Most people get 3 weeks. Some people with longevity get 4 weeks of vacation. With that seniority comes that you don't get laid off as quickly as someone that is an apprentice that's just entered. We have numerous contracts so that wherever you go to work within the granite industry, you are covered by an existing contract. It's very, very valuable for my people, and they love being able to be part of the decision-making process at a ratification vote.
Matt, do you ever find that people I assume that often people who are coming in to your union may have worked in other union shops in the past, so it may not be a foreign idea. But for people who are new to the trade or new to work in general, are there ever any sort of feelings of why do I have to join a union and pay dues? And what is this actually doing for me that you have to explain to people?
I've had that before, yes. I've had some young people that have entered the industry that maybe worked, you know, at other places around Central Vermont or Waterbury and things like that, and there's no union. And so they enter the granite industry, and we have that you're required to become a member after 30 days of employment. And I've had a couple of people, not many, but, you know, say, geez, why do I have to join? And so I go into all the reasons why. One of the biggest reasons is that in order to participate in our pension plan, you have to be a member of the union. So that sort of entices them to say, yeah, okay, of course. And but I haven't, you know, usually once I explain it, people are fine with joining the union after that.
Matt Peake is a business agent with the Granite Cutters Association in Barrie, a union that represents more than 300 workers. Matt, thank you very much for talking with us. I appreciate it.
You're welcome.
Jennifer is calling in from Essex. Hi, Jennifer. What are you thinking about?
Hi, how are you?
Great. Go right ahead.
I have some conflicting feelings on the unions, and a lot of it has to do with you know, when the union is providing some sort of protection for the workers or for a population that they're working with, like children or nursing, versus when the union is completely serving and protecting the members kind of at the expense of others. When I was a federal employee on a military base, I had a secretary in a health clinic who, it was a very big HIPAA violation, going in, looking at another soldier's records for a, the wife thought that he was cheating, and looking at medical records, printing stuff off, giving it to this other woman. The secretary admitted that she did it, was put on leave. They did an investigation, found that she had in fact violated the privacy, put a lot of things at risk, and then the union required that she not only be retained in her position where she had access to all this personal information moving forward, she also got all of her back pay, back vacation, and back sick time from when she was out. And we had another gentleman who caused a huge accident, illegally passing a line of six cars where six farm workers were killed in this accident. And he was retained in his job until the day he was sentenced to prison, and it was clear that he would not be able to remain in the position because he had been in the system for 22 years. And so that's where my conflict is that some of the unions really have turned into more of a circling the wagons and a little less about actual reasonable protections for workers and the people that they're working for.
Jennifer, I appreciate your comments and your perspective. Professor McCrate, you know, that is one of the frustrations or arguments against unions that you often hear, is that they let workers who are not necessarily good workers or whose grievance maybe isn't a legitimate grievance sort of get by because of the power of the union. And, you know, Jennifer's looking at some examples that she's seen. What do you think about how unions have been working to combat that, or if that's a perception that's met by reality?
I'm sure there's some of that out there. I'm sure Jennifer was not fabricating that at all. No question about that. But I think what gets lost in the conversation is what unions are doing, as I said before, being at the back of everybody. And often in cases for people who have legitimate grievances and the kinds of things that unions do for everybody who's not even necessarily a member of a union. So they're... a UE organizer in Vermont once told me a story that a local plant, whenever the employer was getting ready to announce the raises, they would call the UE office and say, hey, can you come around here and do a little bit of picketing? And the UE, you know, the UE people knew they weren't seriously interested in organizing. But the fact that a union can even get the attention of the employer, and the people thought it affected their raises. And then there are things that unions do to support higher minimum wages, paid sick days, national health insurance, paid parental leave, that really benefit everybody. And, you know, the bad cases get a lot of press, and they are certainly bad, but there are all these other things going on all the time.
You've also found in your research, though, that in some ways, you know, there may not be as many new unions cropping up, or in certain sectors, there may not be organized labor in the way that we have typically associated it with unions, but people are still sort of organizing to make changes in employment. Can you describe a couple of examples of that?
Well, I did a lot of work this past summer talking to the United Food and Commercial Workers, Local 1006A in Ontario. And what they were addressing in their contract, among other things, was work schedules. And work schedules today for many people are completely crazy. They get 3 to 7 days advance notice. They change every week. If you're paid by the hour, you don't even know how much money you're going to make because you don't know how many hours you're going to get. And many people don't get as many hours as they want. And so their union had been working on this for years. I mean, decades, literally. And ultimately, what they did was they ran a couple of pilots with the employer. The employer was Loblaws, which is a really large grocery store chain in Canada. And they negotiated a contract in which, or they adopted one pilot where the workers get 10 days advance notice. They get schedules for 1 week, and they get them 10 days in advance. And what they also did was that they negotiated minimum hours for people in the largest departments, minimum hours of 28 hours per week. If they wanted them, people didn't have to take them, in the largest departments for the most senior workers, which is extraordinary. I mean, that, you know, schedules are such a huge problem now. And this is a union where they have about 46% union coverage in Canada. So they were powerful. They were able to do it. It's not the norm here.
Yeah, and it's interesting to see people using, learning from how unions have worked to sort of make gains in other areas. It's really interesting to see that happening even today in other sectors of our economy. Elaine McCrade is a University of Vermont professor in the Economics and Women's Studies departments, and I want to thank you for being on the program today. Really appreciate it.
Thank you, Jane.
Paul Searles is with Linden State College. He's an associate professor in social sciences and the author of the book Two Vermonts, Geography and Identity. Paul Searles, thank you very much.
Thank you. It's my pleasure.